This recording is a July 11, 2013 talk by University of Maine Professor Habib Dagher on the Deep Sea Wind Consortium project to build deep water floating windmills and operate them in the Gulf of Maine. In this 37-minute recording, Dagher discusses the case for floating offshore windmills and gives a progress report on Deep Sea Wind's prototype Volturnus, from basic research to its launch into the tidal Penobscot River in Orrington and its present anchoring off Castine, preparatory to future deployment off Monhegan.
Thanks. A great pleasure to be here today, and look forward to share with you what we've been doing here in the state of Maine regarding the Volturnus technology. My contact information, direct contact information, is on the screen in terms of email and then phone number if anyone would like to follow up with questions, specific questions as well. What you see right in front of you is the photograph of the Volturnus 1-3 scale unit that is placed currently off Castine Harbor, Maine, in about 80 feet of water depth. It's tethered to the seabed using three drag anchors. It is about 1,000 feet from shore. It's connected to the grid using an undersea cable. It is an experiment, and we're learning a lot from this experiment as we speak. But what's unique about this technology is that the hull and the tower are made out of concrete and composite materials. It's the first application of concrete and composite materials in offshore wind technology. And so we'll talk about why we've done that and some of the challenges we went through and why we ended up with this particular design. So the outline, I'll talk a little bit about the composite center so you can see where we're coming from and why we've chosen the choices we've made with offshore wind. Talk a bit about the 5 gigawatts by 2030 plan in the state of Maine. Talk about the 150 scale test program that we've undertaken a few years ago to look at multiple offshore wind floating technologies and why we've selected the Volturnus design as part of this effort. And I'll talk a bit about the DOE Advanced Technology Demo Project that we're currently doing to design two full-size 6-megawatt floating wind turbines using the Volturnus technology. I'd like to also start by thanking the Department of Energy, particularly Jose Zayas and Greg Mattet and Michael Hahn and many others who've worked with us for a number of years, allowed us to get to this point, and for the National Science Foundation, who has also supported this effort, as well as the State of Maine and the University of Maine and the Maine Technology Institute. A bit about the Advanced Structures and Composite Center. We have about 180 people who work in the lab, 87,000 square feet of lab space. We've been in operation for 15 years. And we work to bring advanced materials into construction. The idea is to find ways to reduce the cost of construction, increase the lifetime of construction, reduce the LCOE of projects, of offshore wind projects. That's where we come into the aspects of this program. So our strength in the center is finding advanced materials and different ways of building large structures. That's our experience, and that's the experience we brought into this particular project. Examples of projects we've worked on in the past include what you see on the screen at the bottom. This is the all-composite boat for the U.S. Navy SEALs that was designed and built with one of our partners. We've worked on a technology called the Bridge in a Backpack that's won national awards. This is a bridge that can be inflated out of a bag, essentially, and filled with concrete on site. These are composite material tubes filled with concrete on site. It's an example of technologies we've built in the past that have driven us to the designs we have right now for offshore wind. Examples we've done in the past as well. This is the longest composite bridge in the world. It's a 540-foot bridge that was been tested in our lab and built in Maine in 2011. Again, we've used composite materials here in this bridge structure to reduce the corrosion of the bridge and reduce the weight of the bridge because of the foundation conditions. Again, I'm showing that because a lot of these technologies that we've developed over the years apply to the offshore wind technology that we've developed in Volturnus. If you look here, we've got some pilings. The technology we've developed for piling systems that are made out of composites driven into the seabed and filled with concrete on site. And these composite piles, again, are examples of technologies that we've developed that also helps bring to bear what we've done with the Volturnus design. This is the bridge in the backpack technology shown here. These are composite tubes filled with concrete on site, again, to build the bridges faster. this bridge can be built and has been built in 2 weeks' time for a typical two-lane roadway bridge. It's got a life cycle that's about three times that of a typical steel bridge. Again, these are the kinds of technology platforms we've used to apply to the offshore wind problem. This is another technology we've used. This is the Penobscot Narrows Bridge in Maine, the longest bridge in Maine. Some of the cables on that bridge are made with carbon fiber strands that we've worked with the Maine DOT and others to implement and monitor on the bridge. Again, these are the technology platforms we brought together in developing the hull turners. This is the Navy ship hull structure we've built for the Mako boat. This is an 83-foot-long high-speed interceptor for the U.S. Navy SEALs, made out of composite materials as well. Again, a lot of these technology platforms have been brought to bear into what we're doing here with the Volturnus. So turning to the Volturnus project in the state of Maine, the reason for doing a lot of this is, in Maine is the cost of energy in our state. Back in 1998, about 5% of the family budget was used for energy. The yellow, what you see in yellow, is the health care costs for the family, and in green are the remaining funding to live on once you've paid your energy bills and your health care bills. And every circle represents the family budget in Maine in 10-year increments. And in 2008 and 2010, you see that about 20% of the family budget went to energy, and in 2018, we estimate up to 40% of the family budget to go to energy. And the reason for that is at $4 a gallon for gasoline and heating oil, about 70% of us use heating oil in the state of Maine. We're spending roughly $10,000 a year per family to heat homes, to fill up the two cars with gasoline, and pay for electricity. And that's what we're trying to find ways, if you wish, to reduce the long-term uncertainty of energy prices. And we've identified offshore wind in the state as one of the key potential solutions in the long run to reduce the cost of energy and stabilize it for the Maine population. Of course, it's a piece of the solution. The solution is bigger than that, but offshore wind is an important piece of the solution moving forward. And on our plan in Maine, I served on a task force that the governor put together, previous governor put together, and unanimously agreed on a plan of 5 gigawatts of floating offshore wind by 2030 off the Gulf of Maine. And that would be to be connected with a land-based wind grid into a smart grid that would be used to heat homes and reduce our reliance on fossil fuels for heating homes, and also to incentivize the development of and the use of electrical vehicles or plug-in hybrid vehicles in the long run. And, of course, sell the rest of it on the New England grid. So that gives a bit of the reasoning for this. And we've put together a plan, a timeline to reach 5 gigawatts by 2030 in the Gulf of Maine. The timeline is broken up into 5 phases that you see on the screen. This is what we call our clock here for the offshore wind program in the state of Maine. The first phase was completed in 2011, where we tested 3 150-scale designs of floating wind turbines to help us decide which technology works best for the state and for our local conditions. In 2013, this year, we deployed a 1-8 prototype of our favorite design, that's the Volturnus design. And then Maine now has 2 DOE FOA pilot projects that are ongoing, and it is our goal by 2017 to have at least a 12-megawatt pilot farm using one of these designs. And then by 2020 or in the early 2020s, once we've learned more from the 12-megawatt pilot farm, go ahead and build some larger farms in the 500-megawatt range. And then once we build the first farm, go ahead and build a few more farms based on that experience. And if you look at this plan, if you wish, of this clock, it's really a walk-before-you-run approach. It's making sure that we take measured steps as we move forward, identify the risks, identify the challenges, and then make investments on that basis. We live in the Northeast United States. If you're not in the U.S., Maine is the northeastmostern state in the U.S., and we're the closest state to Europe. In the Northeast U.S., this is the offshore wind map, very well known map, put together by the DOE that shows the offshore wind resource in the U.S. As you see, as you move up on the East Coast, north on the East Coast of the U.S., typically the offshore wind resource becomes more consistent. You have stronger winds and more consistent winds. And Maine have very strong, consistent winds. We have about 156 gigawatts within 50 miles of our shores. There are some challenges, though. Even though it's a big resource, there's a lot of challenges to get there. The challenges we have include currently the cost of offshore wind, as we all know, but also the logistics of developing offshore wind in our region. The Northeast region from New York to Maine has about 55 million people, and we pay collectively the highest electricity cost in North America, yet we have a large offshore wind resource off of our coast. So it makes sense for us as a region to look at offshore wind. The challenges we have is we have certain geophysical conditions, certain manufacturing conditions in terms of availability of vessels and the types of vessels to deploy offshore wind. Off the coast of Maine, we have deep waters. When you're about 3 nautical miles off the coast of Maine, we have about 100 meters worth of water depth. So we do need to look at floating wind turbine technologies. And that's the reasoning, if you wish, some of the challenges that we've been facing in this program. So the number one challenge we have is how to reduce the cost of offshore wind so that we are competitive with other forms of electricity in the 2020s, hopefully without subsidies. And DOE has set out a goal a year ago when they created the Advanced Technology Demonstration Program for offshore wind to reach 10 cents a kilowatt hour by in the 2020s when these technologies are scaled up. It's a very challenging goal, and I know DOE is changing some of those goals. We're still looking to see if we can reach that goal. We understand the significant challenges to do so. If we can reach 10 cents a kilowatt hour, at least in the state of Maine, we will be competitive with other forms of electricity with no subsidy. But it remains to be seen whether this is a goal that's achievable. In terms of offshore wind technology, if you're not familiar with it, very quickly, offshore wind has started in Europe back in 1991 when the first offshore wind farm was constructed. And most farms are in relatively shallow waters, typically less than 30 meters. The most typical design is a driven monopod into the seabed, and then a tower and a turbine on top. If you go to transitional depth between 30 and 60 meters, there are other technologies that are used. This is a tripod-type design. But that drives the cost up as well, and there are challenges with going to larger water depth and costs. And then if you go over 60 meters of depth, these transitional technologies, whether they're the tripods or other types of technologies, become fairly expensive. So technologies to float these wind turbines and pre-manufacture them dockside and throw them out to sea is what a number of researchers across the world have been looking at. And that's the technologies we're focusing on in the state of Maine, these deep water technologies. Some of the issues that we face with in our region, in the Northeast region, particularly the Gulf of Maine region, is we lack heavy offshore construction assets. We don't have the jack-up vessels in our region to erect monopiles. The large cranes that will go up on barges, these don't exist in our immediate region. We don't have large manufacturing facilities for steel structures other than Bath Ironworks that makes ships in Maine that are automated, very much like the South Korean facilities that can produce hundreds of ships a year. We're not set up to do that. So the cost of steel construction in our region is relatively high compared to what you can get in Southeast Asia, particularly South Korea. And plus the access to these heavy pieces of equipment, the jack-up barges and the cranes, does not exist in our region, in our immediate region, to the extent that it exists in Europe. Some of this equipment necessary here to place tripods or in the ocean, again, does not exist in the Gulf of Maine. These ships would have to be sourced in other locations, particularly the Gulf of Mexico, brought to the state of Maine. That drives costs up as well. So we've been looking at technologies that would help us get around, if you wish, some of the manufacturing restrictions we have and some of the construction restrictions that we have in our region. One of the advantages to go farther offshore and use floating technologies is potentially address some of these construction barriers that we have. Could we manufacture these units dockside without using jack-up barges, throw them out to sea, and place them offshore? Could that be an opportunity? And if so, what are the advantages that we would see? Of course, if we were to go 20 or 30 or 40 miles offshore, does the wind regime in the Gulf of Maine get to be better? The University of Maine 12 years ago deployed a called the Gulf of Maine Ocean Observing System. It's a series of buoys we've deployed across the Gulf of Maine that measured winds and waves in the Gulf of Maine. We've been collecting all that data for 12 years. And what you see here in this chart in green are buoys that we've deployed over 12 years ago near the coast of Maine, within a few miles of the coast. And what you see in G and H are yellow buoys we've deployed in the Gulf of Maine that are 42 and 56 miles from shore. And after analyzing this data, we've essentially identified that if you were to compare land-based wind in Maine, we have in location A, an existing wind farm. It's a hilltop wind farm in the state of Maine. And if you take that hilltop farm in A and moved it to locations B, C, D, E, and F close to shore, within 6 to 13 miles offshore, or you moved it to locations G and H, which is 42 and 56 miles offshore, the question is, do you produce more energy? And what we found is, if you are near shore in locations B, C, D, E, shown in green, you don't generate more energy than what you generate hilltop in the state of Maine. But if you go farther offshore in locations G and H, you're generating about 33% more energy annually compared to hilltop or near shore offshore. So there's a real economic advantage to go farther offshore. That's one reason we've decided to look more seriously at floating technologies that would help us avoid the use of these jack-up barges and heavy cranes and also allow us to reach these far offshore sites that have a better wind resource. So when we started this work in 2008 and 2009, we looked at a variety of floating offshore hull technologies, and we wanted to see what makes the most sense in our environment. But I'd like to premise that, if you wish, by saying that here our conclusion is that all these designs, whether they're spars, semi-submersibles, or potential leg platforms, are all viable, depending on your existing conditions, your geophysical conditions, your manufacturing conditions, and manufacturing infrastructure in your location. So we're not really saying one is better than the other in all locations. We're saying that you really need to make choices based on your existing infrastructure in terms of what makes the most sense for you. So what we looked at, spar design, we looked at is a semi-submersible design, we looked at essential leg platform design. We designed all three of them. We designed 5-megawatt floating hulls using all three designs. And then using physics, we basically developed 150-scale units of these designs and placed them in a wave wind basin. And you can see these three designs, the spar, the essential leg platform, and the semi-submersible in the wave basin. Notice the semi-submersible has heat plates in it here. And we subjected all three designs each to 60 net ocean conditions that were derived from the Gulf of Maine conditions. They were both operating conditions as well as extreme conditions that looked at different wave to wind directions. We looked at different wave heights, different wave regimes, different wind regimes, and studied how all those designs perform in the Gulf of Maine. Again, our conclusion is all three are viable designs. However, we selected the semi for our work because it made a lot more sense based on the conditions we have in the Gulf of Maine. And here's an example, just one example of the test results that we've seen. What we're looking here is low. These are the nacelle surge accelerations. The surge direction is the direction parallel to the wind, horizontal parallel to the wind. That's called the surge direction. And then we're looking here at the lower tower bending moments. These are the bending moments at the base of the tower. And we're only looking here at a few conditions, and we're looking at a wave frequency range from 0 to 0.5 hertz, and during that, within that range, what we find is that the response to the wave energy range for the spar here had the highest response in terms of surge acceleration. The TLP had the second highest response, and the semi had the least response. Also, if you look at the tower bending moments in this case under this particular condition, again, I would like to premise that this is a particular condition and these charts don't apply globally to any to all conditions. They apply specifically to the conditions, the loading that we're looking at in this case. And this, we have a significant wave height of 10.5 meters in this case. And you see the spar had the largest bending moments at the base. The TLP had the second largest spending moments of the base, and then the semi had the least spending moments of the base. Again, these are conditions inspired in the Gulf of Maine, and only in the Gulf of Maine that would caution about taking these results and expanding them to other conditions. But the conclusions we've reached based on examples like this is that we prefer the semi-submersible for a variety of reasons. Now, I'd like to also premise these tests here that I'm showing, stickless tests, don't include any pitch control on the turbine to slow the motions down. We have looked at pitch control algorithms that would also reduce all of these numbers, both for the TLP fired and semi down as well, but still decided that the semi works the best for us. Based on these results and based on the conditions in the Gulf of Maine, the semi was selected as the most viable, we believe the most viable for our conditions in Maine. And so we decided to build a 1-to-8 scale version of a semi design we call the Volturnus. The Volturnus design was 1-to-8 scale, was fabricated at the University of Maine campus on our offshore wind lab, and it was shipped in components to Brewer, Maine, which is Brewer is a city right on the water, at a facility for a company called Chimbro. It was assembled at a Chimbro in components, placed in the Penobscot River, and then it was towed down to Castine, Maine, where it is currently being tested. It's moored in about 80 feet of water off Castine, Maine. Now, why did we pick Castine, Maine? I'd like to explain the location. Our unit that we built is a 1-to-8 scale of a larger unit, a 6-megawatt machine. And the 1-to-8 scale unit required a 1-to-8 scale wave environment so we can get similar response for the 1-to-8 scale in a 1-to-8 scale wave environment as you would see offshore, 20 or 30 miles offshore for a full-size unit in a full-size wave environment. So the question was, where within the Gulf of Maine we have regions that have 1-to-8 scale wave environments. We built a wave model for the Gulf of Maine and identified a number of regions that have 1-to-8 scales, and we selected Castine because of our work with Maine Maritime Academy and the logistics of deploying off Castine. So we went to the site where our model said we had 1-to-8 waves and put some wave measurement devices in the water, measured the wave environment in that region, and proved to ourselves that we indeed have 1-to-8 scale environment off the coast of Castine, Maine, and selected that site for our 1-to-8 scale test. But the next question is, it is a 1-to-8 scale wave environment, but it's not really a 1-to-8 scale wind environment. So since we can't change the wind speed at that site, what we had to do is downsize the turbine. So we've reduced the turbine rotor size by about one half in terms of radius or diameter because get thrusts on the turbine that are comparable to a thrust that would be required for a 1-to-8 scale experiment. So when you'll see photos later on the Volturnus 1-to-8 scale, it is a downsized turbine. The turbine is supposed to be twice as big roughly in diameter because of the scale experiment that we conducted. This is a slide of the construction, the 1-to-8 scale in our lab at the University of Maine Offshore Wind Lab. We built that over a 4-month period in our laboratory in components. And you can see this is the formwork for the concrete hull that we built in the lab. And this is a shot of the turbine, of the hull in our laboratory, the 1-to-8 scale hull, completed in the lab, ready to be disassembled and taken to Brewer, Maine to be reassembled and launched. The design of the hull has been designed to be disassembled and reassembled because it's hard to move it on the road. It's too big. You can see here in red, this is the draft line, the estimated draft line, and we painted in red. This is an anti-fouling paint that we have on the unit. The tower sits in the center. The hull is all made out of concrete, as you see in this case. And this is the day we launched it. It was launched May 31st in Brewer, Maine. It was reassembled in Brewer, Maine and launched. You can see the hull right there. The whole unit was picked up with a crane. You can see the crane and the triangular lifting arrangement that lifted the unit from the three radial columns. We have three radial columns, buoyancy columns on the unit that was lifted and placed it in the water. Here's another shot before it went into the water in Brewer, Maine. What I'd like to point out is that the tower that you see here is made out of composite materials, so that the whole tower is made out of composite, and the the hull is made out of concrete. And that's what makes the design very unique. The composite tower and the concrete hull collectively provide corrosion resistance that we're looking for, reductions in maintenance costs. And we're looking at a life cycle for these assets, the hull and the tower, in excess of the typical 20-25 years assets with a significant reduction in maintenance requirements for these units. And that's one reason we went in that direction. The concrete hull also can be manufactured in our state, in our region, without access to steel heavy manufacturing facilities using technology that currently exists in our region. And this is the unit when it was placed in the water in Brewer, Maine, ready to be towed offshore. The towing operation that we use is a very important experiment for us. The unit has a large number of instrumentation, a large instrumentation package that will give us a lot of information on the unit. That will point out some of the instrumentation package information. We have essentially a set of strain gauges near the top of the tower that are calibrated to give us the thrust, the wind thrust on the unit. We have also right up here a set of accelerometers. We also have another set of accelerometers down further down as well. There's actually three sets of accelerometers on this unit. We also have strain gauges on the unit and load cells on the mooring lines. And we also have wave staff units on each one of the radial columns. You can see the wave staff right here that will measure waves, incident waves coming to the unit. The unit communicates to shore wirelessly to provide data, continuous data on its operations. This is a tow-out operation. This was a very critical stage for us for the research program. A key part of this technology is the ability to be towed out relatively easily using small tugboats. It is our intention for the 6-megawatt machines to use 20-ton tugboats, and this experiment here, the tow-out experiment, was to prove out that this is a technology that can be relatively easily towed out. We have calculated, for example, based on our models, that we would have about a 7,000-pound tow-out load at about 2 nautical miles of speed. And so we were monitoring during the tow-out operation the tug line forces and the speed, of course, of movement, and we were able to prove to ourselves that, indeed, at 2 nautical miles of speed, relative to the water, we're seeing 7,000 pounds of a tow line force. We chose to use a leading tug for the towing operation and a trailing tug that will help direct the unit around obstacles. And we had also three other vessels that security vessels that actually went followed the unit as well to alert other mariners that the unit is coming across as well. The initial part of the tow out was in a river. It was very still water. It took us about 12 hours to tow out the entire unit. This is a shot of the unit when we got under the largest bridge in the state of Maine. This is the Penobscot Narrows Bridge. Again, you can see here the chase boats, the security chase boats, the trailing vessel right here, and then the leading vessels you can't see here. This unit has already been under the bridge. We were measuring accelerations during the tow-out operation. Here's a shot when we reached the more open ocean near the Penobscot Bay area. You can see the leading tug vessel, the trailing tug vessel. On June 2nd, when we arrived in the open ocean environment, near open ocean environment in Penobscot Bay, there was a significant change in the weather. We had actually tornadoes hit in the state of Maine at that time, and we saw 4 to 6 foot wave at the time and over 30 mile per hour winds. And that was the most severe environment the unit has seen since then, because the June and July environments in Maine are relatively mild offshore. To put that in perspective, the 4 and 6 foot waves that we've seen, multiply those by age if you wish, is 32 to 48 foot waves when you compare it to a full size unit. These would be very extreme weather events, 48 foot waves on a full size unit, and you wouldn't be wanting to be towing in that environment. So there was a very interesting experiment. We had accelerometers during that event, and we measured the accelerations of the unit, and it towed out extremely well in this very extreme environment. And actually, the tugboats were having a difficult time during the tow-out operation. Here's a shot. You can see the wave height with respect to the tugboat the tacos were bouncing around quite a bit, and the personnel of the tugboats saw very severe movement. As I said, up to 6 foot waves, and the Volturnus during that whole event that did extremely well and had very very minimal movement, and they were compatible with what was expected and calculated using our models. This is the unit in its final position off Castine Harbor in 80 feet of water. As I said, we have three mooring lines on the unit. We have an undersea cable that's connected to the grid, the central main power grid. What you see in the background is a floating LIDAR that was also built at the university and deployed to help collect additional data at the site. I show here in the circle relative diameter of the full-size units versus the geometry of the hull. As I said earlier, the diameter is downsized because of the 1:8 scaling requirement. So the real diameter would look like what you see here inside the large dotted circle for a full-size unit. I'd like to show you briefly here the floating LIDAR that was placed also at the site. We call that the deep-sea LIDAR. Again, that was built in our lab at the university. We have about 12 years of experience building buoy systems at the University of Maine, and to collect data on winds and wave in the Gulf of Maine, we've used that experience to build a floating LIDAR system. This floating LIDAR is being tested right now versus land-based LIDAR. It can measure wind speeds at different elevations, and it is powered using both horizontal and vertical axis wind turbines, as well as solar power, and it can operate autonomously for 6 months. And of course, that remains to be seen. We're testing the unit as we speak, and that supplements the data collected on winds and waves. They have wave measurement devices, wind measurement devices. It also has acoustic sensors to listen in for birds and bats for the unit. Going back a bit, the unit has a number of cameras on it. Let me go back one shot. The cameras from shore are looking at the unit, and we're collecting data in terms of birds' interaction with the unit and bat interaction with the unit using the cameras on a 24-hour cycle. And we have people reviewing these bird interactions every day to ensure that to understand better the bird's interaction with the unit. So that's part of our environmental ecological monitoring aspects of this program. The next phase of the program is under the DOE FOA project, the Advanced Technology Demonstration Program. Our intention is by 2016 to place the first 6-megawatt turbine in the unit in the water. This is what they look like. They're the Volturnus, same Volturnus design that we've shown you a little earlier. It's quite a bit bigger. This is an Airbus. Largest Airbus gives you a sense of the size of these units. We're looking at close to 140-meter rotor diameters in that range, plus or minus. We are in the process of designing these two full-scale units as we speak based on the experience we've had with the 1:8 scale. By 2014, we should have 100% design completed and the cost estimated. In 2015, if all goes well, we start construction. In 2016, the first turbine will be connected to the grid, and in 2017, the second turbine will be connected to the grid. These two units will be placed in a test site off Monhegan Island in the Gulf of Maine, and that's the test site. This test site was established by Maine Public Law, Maine Public Law 270 in the science of the university. It's within 3 nautical miles of an island called Monhegan Island. Monhegan Island, this is the state of Maine you see on the upper left-hand corner, and the detail in red is what you see in here. Monhegan Island is about 12 miles offshore, and the test site that the University of Maine has a lease on is about within 3 miles off Monhegan Island, so it is in state waters, and that makes it a lot easier for us to permit units in that test site within the state statute. The state has to, once an application is put in for a new piece of hardware to go in that test site, the state has to respond to us within 2 months with a yes or no. So it's a fairly expedited permitting process. Once you have all the environmental ecological data pulled together. That takes time, of course, and we've already done that. So the wind speeds at the test site are about 9.2 meters per second, average annual wind speed at 90 meters. The predominant wind directions are northwest in the wintertime and southwest in the summertime. We have 12 years of mid-ocean data at that site. We've done the bottom sampling and bottom characterization, core sampling. We've also done fish, bird, bat, and bed tank surveys over the last 2 to 3 years, which allowed us to receive a fund from DOE back in 2011 for a scale project at that site. So in summary, we've talked about the main 5 gigawatts by 2030 plan. We've talked about the Volturnus unit that we've developed. The Volturnus is a unique semi-submersible hull made out of concrete and composite materials. It can be manufactured dockside. There are no jack-up barges needed, no heavy cranes needed. The goal here is to reduce operation maintenance costs and extend the life beyond the typical 20 or 25 years. It is our expectation here, again, this is based on a testing we're doing right now and another testing, that we should be able to have multiple lifetimes, multiple 20-year lifetimes out of the hull and tower combination, which in the long run would help reduce the cost of offshore wind by being able to reuse some of the assets. And, of course, the turbines would have to be maintained or replaced on a schedule. However, the hull and tower then would be more, if you wish, fixed assets over the long run. In terms of the Volturnus development, we took a very careful approach to select a design that works for our conditions. The challenges we have is that we don't have large steel manufacturing facilities that are cost-effective in our area. We don't have large cranes and large jack-up barges. So we wanted to work within the existing infrastructure in selecting a design. So we looked at three designs at the 150 scale. The spar, the semi, and the TLP, and selected the semi design. We then went back and built the 1-8 scale to help de-risk the technology and build the LIDAR as well in 2013. And now we're moving on to the next phase of the program, which is designing 2 full 6-megawatt machines and then a commercial farm in the early 2020s in the 500-megawatt range and beyond. Right now we're heavy into data collection for the Volturnus 1-8. There's a lot of data coming in. We're evaluating this data. A lot of the interesting data will start to occur in November, December, January, and February. We plan to keep this unit, the Volturnus 1-8, in the water for a year and collect the data necessary to improve the design. So I'd like to, of course, acknowledge all of our partners in the program. From our viewpoint, what was very, very rewarding for all of us is in Castine, Maine on June 13th, at noontime, we were able to start generating electricity and have offshore wind electrons flow into the U.S. grid. Thank you very much.